things I don't know how to play, and I don't want to anyway. Need to delete this game and go back to another save. But my hard drive sparked zero charisma, zero luck. I don't have any skills or the XP to fix my.
Hello and welcome to the 30th episode of the National Institute for Gamer Review. I am DK.
I am Lewis, and I've paid $9.99 a month to be here with all my friends.
Haven't we all? Haven't we all? Did that was the original price? I thought they raised it. Is that not? I don't know.
Didn't they go free to play? We'll get into it. I think we'll get into the pricing history.
Yeah. So if you can tell from the title and discussion, today we're going to be discussing World of Warcraft with a particular emphasis, I think, on the lore of the Warcraft setting. When we were sort of planning this out, and we've been meaning to talk about Warcraft for a while, it's obviously just a hugely important franchise and element of the PC gaming, or just the gaming landscape generally. It's something that we've been meaning to discuss. I think there's like several different angles to take on it, one of which is which to me is the primary experience that I have with Warcraft, which is the real-time strategy. You know, just it was not the first real-time strategy game, but really kind of solidified the genre in a way that that was just provided the template for all future games. Yes, you know, we discussed Dune 2, which was kind of technically the first in that sense, or what was that other? There was that Sega Genesis title, but that had a commander unit and stuff. But basically, it was Warcraft that really put real time strategy games on the map in a big way, or Command and Conquer simultaneously with that. And but then something funny happened, which was that as Blizzard got really huge. Well, as Blizzard transitioned from, which people should know, obviously, was the company that made Warcraft games. The games were very successful. The real-time strategy games were very successful, but they had an idea for a massively multiplayer game, along the lines of, I think at the time, EverQuest was the big MMORPG. I don't even think EverQuest was technically the first. I wouldn't know, but that was the first really big one, really popular one. And they're like, we can do EverQuest, but with World of Warcraft, you know, setting and characters and all, and with that Blizzard touch, which it, you know, also some amount of accessibility. Although that's, I guess, another topic we can touch on is these. You know, the game has definitely gotten more and more accessible and dumber, as I understand it, as it has gone on. It didn't originally have quest marker arrows or anything like that, but yeah, they made a massively multiplayer online RPG, World of Warcraft, and ever since then they really haven't been the same company. I guess eventually they ended up putting out another they eventually put out a sequel to StarCraft, and that's, we'll have to talk about StarCraft another day as well. But that I think really the distance, the gap, the transition from Warcraft 3 to World of Warcraft was, I think, the kind of number one that was absolutely definitive for Blizzard as a company and for the setting and for just everything, really. I mean, in a lot of ways, PC gaming as a whole, or just gaming as a whole, has been very different as a result of that transition. And So then there's how do you talk about Warcraft? Well, you could talk about it as a real-time strategy game. You can talk about World of Warcraft specifically as an MMORPG, or you can talk about MMORPGs generally, and World of Warcraft is obviously just kind of another one of these, not the first in the genre, but kind of genre defining ever since. Or you could talk about the lore, and that's, I think, mainly what we're here today. I generally think, you know, lore fagging is gay, and I'm not like, I actually, you know, one of my takes and one of the things that I'm most, I most lament in that what I really see is the decline and fall of Blizzard is an increasing emphasis on lore to the exclusion of good storytelling. You know, Warcraft 2 in particular, I think, had a basic, you know, Warcraft 1 didn't really have much in the way of a narrative at all. It was quite basic. Warcraft 2 wasn't much less basic, but it at least it did, you know, with kind of chunky, you know, just it had hero units. They didn't really have much in the way of personality, but they had some, and it was trying to tell some kind of a story that really got actually much better in the expansion, Tides of Darkness, which was a direct lead into Warcraft 3, which is where they really took off. And again, Warcraft 3, which I think we're going to talk some amount about in terms of the lore, is where the again, you have this kind of like, you know, Greek tragedy style thing with chunky, you know, extremely blocky characters, but it works. It works because it's telling a kind of classic story of, you know, people with divergent interests coming together in the face of adversity of a much greater threat. The quest for power, consuming, ruining, destroying, you know, the fatally flawed tragic hero who seeks the power. I mean, these are kind of, you know, these are dramatic themes going all the way back to the origins of drama in the Western tradition. And it was, you know, again, it's not like high art or great theater or anything, but it does the job well enough. It understands its limits and executes well within those limits. Then it just became, in my opinion, but I would defend it, you know, like, and this, you really see this especially in StarCraft 2, and I think in novels, which I've never read, and stuff, where it just becomes lore for the sake of lore. And I don't know, maybe there's some good stuff in there. I wouldn't know. I couldn't tell you. But that's what our guest here is for. So if you want to say hi to the audience, yeah.
Hey, it's Ty Guy. How's everyone doing? Hello, am I here? Hello?
No, you're here.
Oh, cool. Sorry. It was silence. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm really excited with talking about World of Warcraft lore because it was pretty much my childhood growing up. Between that and like football practice and wrestling practice, like I used to go home and like wanting to play World of Warcraft. I used to like pretend getting sick to play World of Warcraft. So it's going to be really exciting to like kind of get into it. And there's a particular character I really want to kind of gravitate towards when we get, I guess we'll start the beginning of sort of the lore at a high level, excuse me, and make our way to Grom Hellscream, Orc Hitler. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, and Grom was, as I was saying before, like, so...
Oh, no, not Grom. Grosh Hellscream.
Grosh is his son, I believe, his son yeah. In the lore, yeah. Well, that's why, so when you were initially talking about, like, things like, I don't remember Grosh, but Hellscream is familiar. And I was like, oh yeah, Grom Hellscream is one of these in the Warcraft 2 expansion, Tides of Darkness, which I think really much more so than the original than the base game, really does try to it's where you first see Blizzard do this thing that they would, I think, really perfect in Warcraft 3 of, you know, you have hero units that look visual, basically they're just color swapped sprites of your regular units, but they have special stats and they have, you know, dialogue lines, and they really sell it and it really works. And Grom, I don't think anyone who ever played Tides of Darkness could ever forget Grom Hellscream. He's just very, very memorable and well done character. Yeah.
Yeah. He was so Grom, and I never played Warcraft 1 or 2, even though I kind of want to, because I have this sort of tism for like classic games. Is that I actually hated Warcraft 3. I actually played it years after the fact, when I was an adult.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, when I was living in Germany. Yeah. And I hated Warcraft 3. I just thought it was a silly RTS, probably because I didn't play it during its time, right? But Warcraft 1 and 2, they're very basic games, right? They were like orc versus human, and then like Warcraft 2 introduces elves and like trolls and stuff, right? And you have like those as your allies. If you're like the Horde, which is like the orcs, and the Alliance, which is like the humans, elves, dwarves, right? And Grom Hellscream, I don't know if this happened in Warcraft 2, but he was the first orc that take the demon blood from the Burning Legion if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if that was in Warcraft 2 or if that was expanded upon.
I believe that was retconned. Like I'd have to double check. He wasn't the thing in Warcraft 2, and particularly the expansion was you. That's really where you for the first time. So there's a it's kind of developed like in Warcraft 1. It's basically just here's the orcs. They're coming from a different dimension. They have like demons and stuff, but that's not really emphasized and it's not really set up or understood. It's just kind of like it's just kind of there. In Warcraft 2, the base game, it sort of hinted at that, very, very obliquely that the orcs are kind of they're like fleeing something, but it's not clear what exactly.
Yeah.
And then in the expansion, which is really as I keep saying, like that's where a lot of this stuff first they start working on it. That's where it's kind of more like you're actively fight. There's like orcs that are aligned with the demons and orcs that are against them, and Grom is against them, as I recall.
It's funny because the kind of like spoil a little bit. They actually revisit this in an expansion of World of Warcraft called Warlords of Draenor, which is where
and Draenor is like that's the opening levels of the Warcraft 2 Tides of Darkness take place on Draenor, which like was new for the series.
Yeah. And that was and that actually has to do with and it was destroyed in Warcraft 2, right? It like looked like a hellscape, right?
Yeah, it was kind of a green blasted area. It was just like it was
because that's something, because you actually go back to that specific place in Warcraft, not Warcraft 2.
Sorry, Beyond the Dark, Tides of Darkness is the subtitle. I apologize. Tides of Darkness is the subtitle of the base game. Beyond the Dark Portal.
Beyond the Dark Portal. Yeah.
Yes. That was the, yes, exactly.
Oh, so let's take a couple steps back. For the audience, it's important to know that World of Warcraft lore, Blizzard just ripped off Games Workshop for Warhammer from Warhammer Fantasy Battle. It's like watered down Diet Coke, Warhammer lore. That's what it is. And it's presented in a really digestible manner for like children.
Just did the same thing they did for StarCraft with 40K.
Very much so.
Oh wow, that's funny.
Except for like StarCraft. Here's the thing with StarCraft, especially like in Brood War and the original. Okay, we're kind of getting off topic, but it's important to note, but like in StarCraft Brood War, like in not in Brood War, but like the first game, not StarCraft 2, but the first game. And I think this is what we have to touch on is Blizzard as a company as a whole, is that they had this like Blizzard touch and this imagination. If you go to the cutscenes of StarCraft, you'll really see this cool, gritty, these cool, gritty Marines. And there was like a really particular scene in the StarCraft games where they're trying to blow up some like satellite or space station, like these are the colonial Marines, and they're like they have the nuclear bomb, and it's in an ice chest, and it's like beer in it, and they're like, haha, cold fusion, and the old crack beers start drinking it. I wanted to point that out. It's not Warcraft, but I wanted to point that out is that Blizzard used to have fun. Now this didn't really show up in the Warcraft lore. Warcraft lore always used to be like
it was always more dour, yes. And
yeah, it was I would call it like teenage drama. Whereas like StarCraft used to be more fun, but nonetheless, it shows up in World of Warcraft, where they sort of like they kind of play into that they were this ripoff, watered down version of Warhammer, and they used to have fun and imagination. And then I kind of want to discuss how that kind of goes away later on. But yeah, sorry, let's get back on topic.
No, I think it all is part of the same topic, especially if you want to talk about lore. I think, again, I remember that particular cutscene, and that was a pre-rendered cutscene, but which they did really well even then. But the pre-rendered meaning, in other words, it was like Pixar, kind of computer-generated graphics that weren't being generated by your graphics card on the fly. They were already made, and then they were just playing them like any other video file. But StarCraft, I think, was really the height of StarCraft and Warcraft 3 both are really good, just in slightly different ways. But I think StarCraft probably has a slight edge as far as you just have like palette swapped sprite, pixel sprites of your regular units that are like your special hero units that are, dramatis personae in the screenplay, so to speak, that you're kind of, you know, that's the narrative, but it works. They sell it. The voice acting was really good, as I recall. The whole thing kind of comes together in a really good way. And yeah, it's a simple enough story leaning on universally recognizable dramatic archetypes that again, you have this kind of tragic figure in Kerrigan, right, who becomes the Brood Queen through kind of like she's essentially captured and then turned into this thing. But anyway, yeah, we could talk about StarCraft another time, but yeah, there's the lore in, I think part of Blizzard losing their touch, as you put it, was that magic touch, which, yeah, I totally agree they used to have, is just getting, you know, telling increasingly complex stories. Increasingly, it becomes this comic book phenomenon, I think, where like no one can ever really die, nothing can ever really happen, but you have to fill space.
Yeah, you know? No one's ever really gone. So Warcraft 1, right? I think we can summarize it with like orcs versus humans, and it's like basic, like humans good guy, orc bad guy, right? Warcraft 2, they kind of add more of that story. And again, I didn't play these games. I'm kind of relying on you for this, DK. And then they introduce like the Dark Portal and the demons and Draenor, and they kind of flesh it out. Warcraft 3 is like where they retcon a bunch of stuff and they like put a bunch of stuff together, add a bunch of lore. And they really sort of create the foundation for what is going to be World of Warcraft. I think very important, because I think, so when I played World of Warcraft, this is going to have a lot of my opinions in it, but not World of Warcraft, Warcraft 3, it was years after the fact, but I thought the lore was like pants on head dumb. Like, I just thought it was so silly and stupid. And I thought like one of the more silly characters, like Illidan Stormrage, but like a high level view of, I'll just take a step back. High level view of Warcraft 3, and I'll just include the Frozen Throne, the expansion in there. Orcs versus humans. I actually forget the main campaigns. I know there's an elf camp. We can talk about like each different campaign. So there's like
this is Warcraft 3 now you're talking about.
Yeah, Warcraft 3. We've moved on unless you want to talk about Warcraft 2.
No, I mean, we could talk about, I guess I said, I think Warcraft 2 and that maybe we can talk about that another time. That's fine. Yes, Warcraft 3 has different campaigns for the different races on a model with StarCraft, but much more elaborately and frankly, well done. Very much the kind of height of the Blizzard at the height of its powers.
Yeah, and they do have like compelling characters, and like some of the most iconic Warcraft characters that are still around today in the lore, which is like even in the latest expansion, Shadowlands, it has finally put to bed Arthas. Funny enough, but in Warcraft 3, you have the characters like Arthas and Illidan Stormrage, Jaina Proudmoore, the race mixing cock goblin orc cock goblin, you know, BBC girl, killed her own father, by the way, which is really funny. Like, there's so many things we can talk about. Jaina Proudmoore, I freaking despise her.
Yeah, well, let's maybe put a pin in that, because I'm not familiar with this character at all.
Oh, Jaina Proudmoore? Okay. Anyway, so basically, Warcraft 3 sets the foundations. There's a bunch of different campaigns. You can play as the orcs. I think in Warcraft 3, they talk about how orcs go through Dark Portal to invade Azeroth, which is like the main like planet, right? Okay, I guess this is kind of complicated. And humans don't like it, and so they fight orcs, but orcs actually have a heart of gold. Orcs kind of get defeated, get thrown into a concentration camp in a human slash dwarf kingdom of like Lordaeron, and there's continents and so on, but we'll get that into World of Warcraft. But I just want to kind of summarize Warcraft 3 real quick. But the main characters in sort of Warcraft 3 our Thrall, which is like, we'll call him Orca Jesus or Green Jesus. That's like who he kind of super is. Jaina Proudmoore, Arthas Menethil, which is probably the most important character to talk about, because he's the only character that is worth talking about in any sort of like seriousness as like a really good character that Blizzard did for a while. and there's a few others, but basically you play the old different campaigns with the Eyes of the Races. And they do stuff. There's like night elves and they're doing some whatever, and there's you play as the undead, and it's whatever. We'll talk about it later. But when we get to the expansion Frozen Throne, this is like when Blizzard like is coming out partying sort of storytelling, in my opinion. Like, I know a lot of people who played Warcraft 3 who didn't like the main sort of campaigns, but when Frozen Throne came out, it was like, it was like a really tragic story. So we have Prince Arthas Menethil of Lordaeron, right? And he's a paladin. And in Warcraft, paladins are these like sort of these characters of virtue and righteousness, right? They are like they're the light, which they never really talk about what the light is originally, which is a good thing, right? They just kind of keep it nebulous. They don't explain the religion very much. And they swing big two-handed hammers, and they go against evil, like a classic archetype of like a D&D or like a Pathfinder sort of paladin. And he's got two buddies in the campaign. What I said is Jaina Proudmoore and his God, what is his was it Tyrion Fordring, who was his sort of like his like teacher, his like Jedi teacher, his paladin teacher. I forget the name of the character. It escapes me right now. But anyways, they have to deal with the undead scourge. So it's no longer about orcs versus humans. It has to do with what's called the undead scourge. So what is the scourge? The scourge is like, I want to really gloss over this. They're undead. That's what they are. They're evil undead controlled by demons. Obviously,
Yeah, the
Arthas.
generic. I mean, that's you see this as a trope again. It's not, I mean, it's the same. I guess this would have been around like the first couple of Song of Ice and Fire books would have been already published at this point. Not that obviously George R. R. Martin himself is leaning, but this kind of you see this also in the original Dragon Age of like this, internally fractured political environment, having people having to set aside their differences in the face of this kind of undead scourge, which itself I think is kind of a intentionally or not, certainly drawing upon the kind of victor's history of World War II, right? But in any case, I don't think you need that particular historical context to see the appeal. I mean, it's really it's a Peloponnese, it's a Persian War kind of situation, right? Where you have
essentially
before, yeah.
There's a particular thing I want to kind of want to like talk about Arthas. So Arthas is like the epitome of Chad, I guess. Well, not Chad, but like, yeah, in a way, right? Big swings, big two hammer. He's a big white guy, bulging muscles, right? So he's fighting the scourge with his buddy Jaina Proudmoore, and his dwarf and his like paladin sort of coach, whatever you want to call him. And they get to a particular moment in time in the campaign, and it's called the Culling of Strathholme. The Culling of Strathholme was like the turning point for Arthas, right? Because we have to understand that paladins are
Yes, I
like
remember
these,
this very well. Yes.
yeah, these rites. So my experience of the Culling of Strathholme was during World of Warcraft, the Wrath of the Lich King expansion, which is now in classic form that Blizzard put out. And the Culling of Strathholme is like where you are either like a Chad fascist or like an ineffective conservative faggot. Like that, this is how we determine who you are, because it's a very basic story. So the undead cult that creates the scourge is sending a bunch of wheat that's infected, right? These like grains that are infected that turn people undead, right? And it goes to Strathholme, and basically, the Scooby-Doo gang figures out, like Arthas and his gang figure out, like, hey, Strathholme is in the citizens of Strathholme have ingested this wheat, they're gonna turn soon. And now the undead are a huge problem because every time the classic, like, oh, every time someone dies, they get risen back. Like, it's a big deal, right? The stakes are high. And Jaina Proudmoore and his, paladin, mentor, they're like, oh, what should we do? Like, oh yeah, this is terrible. And Arthas is like, we have to kill every single last one of them before they turn, before this becomes an issue. Like, this sucks. But they're infected, and they're gonna, you know, we'll put them out of their misery before they turn in undead. And I don't want to do it, but this is what we have to do. And Jaina Proudmoore, and this kind of shows like Blizzard's sort of trend of doing accidental based characters, right? Like accidentally based characters. They're like, no, you can't do the effective thing that is going to stop the problem in its tracks, right? And Arthas is like, you know, how about this? Screw you guys. I'm going to do this. So he gets his soldiers and you do the Colin of Stratholme and you start killing civilians. And it's played up as Arthas is distraught about this. He's like, dude, I have to do this. He smashes people with his hammer. Eventually, he cleanses Stratholme, defeats like the sort of, what was his name, Balthazar? I forget what his name was, the demon in charge, but he defeats it. And it's proven that his actions are the ones who saved the kingdom of Lordaeron that day by doing the Colin of Stratholme. But, and this is where, and normally, like, sort of like liberal writers or whatever would say, like, or would write, like, oh, he was wrong in the long run. But no, he was like, he was right in doing this. But they were still, like, saying how wrong he was in doing it. It was this weird thing where the game is telling you, like, yes, this was effective. But all the characters are telling you, like, shaming you for, like, oh, you can't, like, effective measures. Anyways, so Colin is trapped over.
The Reddit term for this is ludonarrative dissonance, which is to say a disconnect between the lud from the Latin root meaning for game and the narrative, right? So the game mechanics are telling you one thing, or just common sense at a certain level, and the narrative as presented by the authors are kind of telling you a different thing. And there's a disconnect there, right? And yeah, this is a classic kind of, I mean, you see this all over the place, especially whenever, like, the funny thing is that games and game mechanics, like, sort of by necessity are going to have to, like, especially any game involving any kind of combat or like violent struggle, which is, you know, like the overwhelming majority of games, very, you know, compare, you know, the people have to go out of their way, like, to avoid that if they want to avoid that. Anything involving combat or deadly violence is sort of by necessity going to like it reduces at a certain level to the effectiveness of that violence, which is to say that like the game worlds tend to produce or tend to imply the existence of a kind of, yeah, you know, Nietzschean zero sum world, which is very, you know, you can have your metaphysical priors or whatever, but that's kind of how the quote real world works to a large extent. So if you want to have game mechanics that involve deadly violence and you also want to have liberal priors and a liberal message, these things are almost always going to be in conflict. And there you see a great example of that. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah, no, I didn't actually know that term. That's good to know. But, okay, so Jaina, let's go back on Jaina real quick. So Jaina Proudmoore is this person who thinks that Colin Stratholme was terrible. Arthas, what are you doing? They were like boyfriend, girlfriend. And it's kind of funny because she, like, gets... It's heavily implied she gets dicked down by the orcs early on in Warcraft 3. And the reason being is she's part of this kingdom, human kingdom called Kul Tiras. And her father is like ultimate Chad, right? Excuse me. And she doesn't want her father, who's been fighting orcs for years and years and years, and people have, and this is like trend in World of Warcraft. For years and years and years, the Alliance versus Horde, people are dying. It matters. Like, it's like World War One. Like, going into World War II, like, people remember their grandfathers and their fathers dying in the previous war. They don't, like, they don't, like, you know, they hold grudges, right? Like, screw you. Like, orcs are bad. Like, we're not going to have it. But Jaina Proudmoore finds the good-hearted, didn't-do-nothing orcs, like Thrall and Rexar, a few others, right? And her father's coming back to Kul Tiras. I forget the setup. And her father's like, Jaina, watch out, those orcs. Meanwhile, she's like wiping the cum off her face, essentially, saying, no, father, these orcs are great guys, right? and her father's like, no, I'm going to kill every single orc, right? And so she ends up killing her father in the fleet because for anti-racism, like unironically, this happens like a couple chapters prior to the Colin to Stratholme. So, and she's like, huh, it was sad killing my father, but I did it because he was a racist. Like, that's essentially what is being said here. And the Kingdom of Kul'Tiras doesn't get revisited till World of Warcraft Legion, which is like the seventh expansion or something in World of Warcraft. Not Legion, Battle for Azeroth. That's what they come back. But they basically kick her out for being a race trader, like race mixer. And then she kind of cozies up to Arthas and becomes like sort of like she wants to settle down with Arthas. And so anyway, so we fast forward back. So we have this character who's going to be a main character throughout World of Warcraft. And she like kills her father without like really crying about it. And when she thinks like the Colin to Stratholme and an effective measure of people that are infected is like a bridge too far. So we, again, this is a trend we're going to see in the writers. Basically, to put a pretty sort of bow on the Arthas Menethil story till if we talk about Wrath of the Lich King, is that he goes to Northrend. He goes to Northrend of his armies. Some mercenaries want to leave. He ends up like killing those mercenaries because he's like, no, I'm going to finish this fight. Right. So again, another base thing is like, dude, you're not allowed to leave this. We're about to finish this fight against the Scourge. He's told about through various means about this a sword called Frostmourne, right? So eventually finds Frostmourne through some battles in Northrend, which is like the northern island continent. And his dwarf buddy was like, no, Arthas, you can't take it. It's a cursed blade. And Arthas is like, I don't care. I can defeat the people that are killing my people. I'll take the blade. So basically, what's really important to know is that Arthas, up until the point he grabs the blade Frostmourne, and this is a very big point in the lore, is that he was under his own freedom, right? He was doing his like freedom of action. When he grabs Frostmourne, that's when he starts getting manipulated by the Scourge and the Burning Legion, which are like the demons, yada, yada, yada. And then he doesn't become himself. So he eventually gets twisted by the blade, goes back to Lordaeron, kills his father, raises the undead, and this is now the rise of the Lich King, to kind of put a bow. And there's a bunch of other lore things that happen, but they're not really important for the overarching sort of thing I'm trying to construct here. Is that we have this character, Arthas, who's basically everyone loves this character. Like, he was very polarizing. Like, if you hated him, it's like you hated him for like, oh, what a tragic character. And he like did evil things, but he meant well at the beginning. Like, power corrupts, like that stupid Marvel crap, right? If you're people like us, like you like we're like doing wrestling, or like we're just like, you know, sort of like, I guess, like young little proto fascists, we're like, no, that's, he did everything right, and it's tragic that he picked up the wrong sword one day and became corrupted and an agent of the Burning Legion. Now he's the Lich King.
Or just that he was too weak in whatever, you know, spiritually, mentally, whatever you want to call it, to wield that power without being corrupted, right? Like, not that the power isn't in and of itself necessarily the problem.
Well, I guess you can kind of take it that way. Yeah, you can take it that way. But the thing is, he went to get the sword because he knew that was the effective measure. And based upon his knowledge, he was going to do the effective measure, right? To save his kingdom and his people. Every action Arthas did was in terms and couched in for his people, right? So I'm doing this for my people. And it wasn't until he brought up that sword and, you know, yes, didn't have like, you know, the willpower to fight off, that's a Lord of the Rings reference, or whatever the orc, Guldran, maybe, whoever that was in the Helm of Domination and Frostborn. But everything was couched in that. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess you can say he was like too weak, and that's the tragedy of Arthas Menethil. But throughout the entire Warcraft 3 sort of scenario, only him and this other character named Lord Garethos are the only characters. Oh, and I guess Jaina's father, who actually act rationally and don't act in these stupid liberalisms, right? Like, the Lord Garethos was a character and he fought for, you know, Arthas's father and Lordaeron, and he was like literally racist. Like he was like the racist character, and they really play him up in Warcraft 3 as the racist. But everything he does is like super effective. And he dies in a really tragic way too. He actually gets killed by a character that we'll talk about later, Sylvanas. And Sylvanas Windrunner, but that's not necessarily that important in Warcraft 3. But anyway, that pretty much wraps up. Do you want to talk anything about Warcraft 3 and the Frozen Throne there, DK, or
no? I think, well, that's the I think there's two major elements to, yeah, to keep in mind is well, like I said, two in a kind of meta thing. So the two things are, one, yes, this kind of I resent the implication. I guess that's the kind of thing that it's just because we live in this gay world where like everyone like 1945 has become the de facto year zero. But before that, and even to kind of more educated people now, I think that in a lot of ways, the better touchstone for the Song of Ice and Fire, Dragon Age, Warcraft 3 narrative of these, you know, yes, this internal dissent that people need to work together to confront this much more severe, you know, truly evil external alien threat is the story of the Persian Wars in ancient Greek history, where yes, you have these, you know, Greek city states that you know, have fought would shortly after they defeated the Persians, you know, like have this cataclysmic apocalyptic battle amongst themselves, the Peloponnesian War. But in, you know, before that, when they were confronted with Xerxes, would have to band together to fight him. And this is also the story that's told, you know, not super well historically, but despite the kind of problems, you know, both historical and, you know, whatever's kind of over the top, obviously, you know, Frank Miller's 300 and the movie based on it do a really good job of telling that narrative. So this is again a kind of story that, you know, completely precedes the attempt to shoehorn any kind of the reason I bring it up is because I think the at a mechanical level, often in games you need a way to like conduct indiscriminate slaughter that isn't morally weighty, which is to say that you need, you know, a bunch of people you don't feel bad about just slaughtering, murdering wholesale. Sometimes you can get around this with like their robots, so they're not actually sentient, all the more so, you know, better if they're like evil robots or robots that are out of control and need to be put down, and it's just like you're not even killing at all. Second best, or and I guess undead are kind of are undead sentient, is a kind of, you know, from this kind of interesting like philosophical question there maybe, and there's this whole thing in philosophy world about like zombies and, you know, all this kind of stuff. I think all that's really dumb, but the point is that kind of debate, I mean, I just think it's pointless and doesn't really actually address any of the questions that it tries to, that it thinks it's addressing. But in gaming terms, it provides you with a kind of solution. And yes, these kind of just the hungry undead who just want to destroy just for the sake of destroying, and there's a lot of them and they all need to be put down, gives you an opportunity to conduct mass slaughter in a kind of morally neutral or even, you know, morally positive way. And then of course the other classic go-to, although less so, there was a period I think in the 90s where the Nazis, where it was easy to just go to, especially in like first-person shooters, you know, Wolfenstein and all this kind of stuff, the original Call of Duties and Medal of Honor. It was just very easy to have Nazis as this kind of faceless enemy that you could just slaughter. And so I think, you know, for a lot of overlapping reasons, people tend to think of like, you know, Nazis and the undead, kind of put them in the same category, at least as far as the morality of killing, which obviously we have our like huge problems with that, right? But you know, you can sort of understand the reasons why. If you're a game designer, you don't spend any time thinking about like revisionist history of the Second World War. You just want a way that, you know, you can let players have a power fantasy, and that's a way to do it, and that's tapping into kind of pre-existing psychological structures that everybody's going to kind of understand implicitly. So that's one angle. And then yes, the other angle, which is the kind of main dramatic thrust of the story, is again, yes, this Arthas is a paladin. He's a good guy. He's like sworn an oath. he's, you know, he's like better than the average good guy. Like humans have a kind of wide range of, you know, there's, you know, better humans and worse humans. Paladins are supposed to be among the best. He is the, you know, the prince. He's supposed to be concerned with the welfare of his kingdom. He's so concerned that he's worried, you know, I don't, you know, I need more power. I need this artifact that's going to grant me this power, that's going to allow me to defend my kingdom in the maximally effective way. And it corrupts and destroys him, right? And I think we can all kind of relate to that at some level, or at least the kind of psychological structures undergirding that narrative.
Yeah, yeah. So, then, like,
yeah,
Blizzard did like a good job. I would say like a competent job. I mean, I have my definitely have my problems with sort of the lore. But yeah, no, I think you hit the nail on the head there. So I guess we can talk about, so World of Warcraft 3 ends and it's overwhelming success, right? So people want more of it. So people are thinking Blizzard's going to put out Warcraft 4. I mean, StarCraft's also another success at this time. I think Brood War is out, or maybe a couple of years prior. And Blizzard has this, like, they make fun games, they make compelling stories. If you like it or you don't, you have problems with it, but it's still like a competently sort of done story, especially if you know the Chronicles of Arthas. But then they announced in 2004 World of Warcraft. And here's World of Warcraft played a very significant part of my young life, which is a very sad to say, but this is like welcome to being a millennial. And I loved World of Warcraft. When I started playing it in 2004, 5-ish, I was like in 6th or 7th grade or something, right? And I did not play Warcraft 3 prior. So when this game came out, it was a gigantic world that you can like lose yourself in. It was insane to go. And sort of like what they really did well in World of Warcraft is they made sort of your adventure to like level 60, which was the max level, and the world as a main character. So like your journey and your experience and your interactions with other players, you know, World of Warcraft being an MMORPG, as like the characters, and really the lore was kind of in the background. It was so much in the background that, like, you know, you'd maybe read quest logs, but you would kind of, especially as a young kid. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I remember hearing about, again, I've never, my experience with World of Warcraft is only, and I've read a considerable amount about it, but it's only through reading about it. But yes, I do recall one of the things that people would say is that, yeah, basically the lore, the narrative is really, it's all in the quest logs. It's a bunch of reading. You don't have to do hardly any of it if you don't want to. It won't necessarily impact your experience of the game at all.
No, and it's set in a world where it's like so massive. So like I played a human, right? Like my first like character, and there's races and there's classes, right? So I played what was like a
alliance fag detective.
Yeah, I was an alliance. Well, it's funny. I've gone full like. We'll talk about Garrosh Hellscream, who's just like the actually. They it's funny. It's like Sly Marbo in Warhammer 40K, where it says survived 8 GW retconnings to the face and still lives. Garrosh Hellscream took the freaking stupid hammer from Blizzard and still came out like Chad. Ultra nationalist racist, but that's like a few expansions down the line. But World of Warcraft, what was really cool is like, especially when you're a kid and you kind of don't want to read, I actually read all the quest text, but I didn't really understand who Arthas Menethil was, or the Lich King, or the Dragonflights, or or the Titans, or who these like whatever were. So now, and a lot of it in World of Warcraft, a lot of the quests and a lot of the zones you're in and questing in, it wasn't like end of the world scenarios that you were dealing with, which was cool. It's good storytelling. Like, so I played an alliance rogue when I first played the game. I eventually switched to paladin, but a rogue, you can go stealth and you have two, you know, you're dual wielding and you're like this, you know, you're a rogue, you're like a spy. It's cool. And the first couple of levels in sort of the human path you take in World of Warcraft, you're dealing with like what it's called. You're dealing with a few different enemy types, and they all have these stories. And there's really the music is so beautiful, and there's rivers and lakes and trees. The world's massive, and you're mining and you're skinning and you're killing and completing these quests. But like sort of like the start of the sort of storylines that it's kind of portrayed is the tale of the Fias Brotherhood, and this is like, in my opinion, the best story that Blizzard has ever put out. So the Defias Brotherhood, and you fight them in Elenwyn Forest, and you eventually go to this. My favorite, like, place in the entire game is Westfall, and Westfall is this farming area that is, I think it's in drought, and there's this gang of thieves, the Defias, that have set shop in there, and all the farmers are kind of afraid of them. And so you start doing quests there, like, we have to root out the Defias, because the reason why you're, like, going around killing people and stuff in the name of, like, the Alliance or the Horde, well, specifically in the Alliance, when you're playing the Alliance characters, all the armies are fighting the Horde, or overseas fighting something. They don't have time for domestic issues. And so the kingdoms are strained in this sort of time period, in this time of World of Warcraft. So they, hey, citizen, you look strong. Go get a sword and go beat up some, you know, poor criminals or whatever. And you kind of find out the story through the Defias quest that they're the Defias Brotherhood, though they're a criminal gang now, as they were once. Once a stonemasons guild that actually built the human capital city of Stormwind, and they were actually they built it after what the third war, right, where it gets destroyed. And it's in the Warcraft 2 or Warcraft 3 where Stormwind gets destroyed by, you know, the Horde. And so you know, they did like an Obama type stimulus package to, like, you know, let's pay the stonemason guild to rebuild Stormwind. And the Stonemason Guilds rebuild Stormwind, and the guy in charge of it was this guy named Edwin Van Cleef. And basically what happens is the Stormwind nobles go like, yeah, screw this, dude. We're not going to pay you. So they did all this work to rebuild Stormwind and, you know, this beautiful architecture. And they're told to go kick rocks. Like, you did it for your kingdom, dude. You're not going to get paid. So people are starving. They're in, like, recession. And so Edwin Van Cleef goes like, you know what? Screw this. We're going to get a revenge on Stormwind. He starts the Defias Brotherhood and ends up going into the Dead Mines in Westfall to, you know, hatch his plan. And so when you're playing through the quest, you're like, wait, we're going after the people who were gypped from the 1%, the nobles of Stormwind. We are killing the people that just wanted to feed their families. That's like essentially what you're doing. And so sort of this gets gets all culminated in this, the first dungeon you do called the Dead Mines, and it's a really iconic dungeon in World of Warcraft. And you eventually fight through the Dead Mines, and you find out that the Defias were building a super weapon, this giant battleship of cannons, to destroy Stormwind to get their revenge. And you end up killing Van Cleef and cutting off his head to show to the, you know, the militia storm of Westfall that you've defeated the Defias Brotherhood. But the entire time, you're like, if you're reading the quests, you're like, even as like in 2005, when I was like in seventh or eighth grade, I was like, dude, like, why are we doing this? And this kind of shows you where Blizzard is going with a lot of these storylines. And there's the world's mess. So you go on from Westfall and you go through the world and you have these great, and they're localized. And it's really good storytelling at these quests. Like, and it's nothing's like until the end of the game is like the end of the world speaking. It's like you're kind of like solving local issues. And so the stakes are kind of low, but since your character is kind of like this budding adventurer, it's high for your character, but it's not really high for like the world in general. And that kind of culminates when you get to the end game and you get to do raids, go kill like these, like, you know, dragons and elemental god sort of things. And the quest line reads, gather an army and defeat this big bad. And that's because in the underlining reason is because we're too busy fighting the Horde. And throughout the game, you're killing, if you're on a PvP server, you're like killing Horde and screw the Horde, screw the Alliance, you know, for the Alliance, for the Horde, all that jazz. But, and Horde are in mud huts and are pretty much just brown people. But an Alliance have, like, you know, technology and architecture. But World of Warcraft, especially in vanilla WoW, the original thing was like this really sort of like the setting was beautiful, and the world was massive, and your character was your character, and you were like doing these morally ambiguous things with, like, you know, killing, you know, the Defias for getting tied up loose ends for a bunch of rich nobles, and like doing these cool things. It was a really magical experience, and it was a massive hit. People were 6 million people played World of Warcraft when it came out back in 2004-2005. It was an amazing thing, and the gameplay, it was like the first sort of MMO that was really accessible, that was like, it was sort of a casual experience. It was super casual compared to like things like EverQuest or Ultima Online, so you didn't have to grind as much. You had quests, you had professions, you just... Anyways, I could go on and on and on. But yeah, guys, do you have anything to add to that or questions?
Well, I didn't quite... So when did you... So there were, as I recall at release, there wasn't much endgame content, which is pretty standard for big, you know, live service slash massively multiplayer games. But the first couple expansions didn't have... Or I guess maybe you could fill me in. So when did the transition to, we got to save, you know, the world from Big Blue Laser or whatever, when did that happen?
So like in the original WoW, the first raids were like Molten Core, where you defeat this guy named Ragnaros, who was like an elemental sort of like god, right? And that was a big bad. And there's actually more of an interesting story between like the followers of Ragnaros and followers of the Black Dragonflight, which were like the Black Rock Orcs, and the Black Iron Dwarves. And they inhabited this mountain called Black Rock Mountain, which is looks like, it literally looks like Mount Doom, and it's in the middle of the map in the Eastern Kingdoms, like the continent. But there's always been sort of like, hey, go kill C'Thun, the old god, in Ankaraj, right? There's kind of been that, and in the last, the sort of the bow, pretty bow on the original classic WoW, or vanilla WoW rather, is you have to go into Naxxramas and defeat one of the Lich King's top guys, which is named Kel'Thuzad. But it's never couched in a way of like, you're the main character, you're the hero, you're like a nobody that like goes with a bunch of other people, and you know, you have to go in there prepared. So you kind of have that in the classic WoW. In Burning Crusade, so that's the next expansion that happens. This happens in like 2005, 2006. And yeah, it's new world. You go back to Draenor through the dark portal, like we were talking about at the very, very beginning of the show, right? And you're going to Draenor, which is now called Outland because it's all destroyed and stuff. And you're fighting the Burning Legion. I'm going to tell you right now the story in... And you fight Illidan Stormrage. You actually fight and kill him. It's not important to talk about him because he's a stupid character, but... You go in there and you fight Illidan Stormrage in a raid, and these are the old endgame stuff, and you fight the Blood Elf guy, the leader, I think, Quel'Thalas. Yeah, Quel'Thalas. I guess it's important to kind of take a step back and talk about Burning Crusade as a whole and why it wasn't important. So when WoW was getting stale, and you have to understand, not a lot of people were doing the endgame because it was really hard back in 2005 to like get 40 people together and organize that and be good enough to defeat bosses. Because like, I guess like gamers have just gotten so much better and more skill better, like, or have a higher skill. Because now like people go back and play classic WoW and the raids are so easy, but they remember them so hard. Like it was so hard. And it's just simply not the case. But not a lot of people saw the endgame content. So when Blizzard made the Burning Crusade, they did a lot of different things, right? People were hyped for it. They announced there's going to be flying mounts, which, by the way, ruined the game. Screw flying mounts. Destroyed world PvP. Nonetheless, I get off my high horse there, my soapbox there. But flying mounts, they added two new races, the Goat, Draenor, and the Alliance got. Draenei. And the Blood Elves, which were like these really cool characters. And Blizzard has never done any freaking lore of these guys outside of Burning Crusade. But the Blood Elves were these High Elves. You might remember this from Warcraft 3, DK, where they got their magic through the Sunwell. And they were addicted to magic. They were literally like drug addicts, and they had to have magic. In fact, if you queue up the trailer for Burning Crusade, you'll actually see this beautiful blood elf woman character like sucking the life out of like an animal for its mana, and because it's addicted to like the magic, right? They're Carolyn addicts. They're these really cool flawed characters, and they join the
Horde. Okay, yeah, maybe this, because you can clarify this, because I was looking, Sylvanas is actually a hugely important character. I believe she was a big character in Warcraft 3, and I think an even bigger, I guess, in recent World of War. I mean, recent as of this recording,
yes,
late in the development cycle, World of Warcraft. I remember her in Warcraft 3 as a night elf, and there was some kind of distinction between like the night elves and the high elves that I didn't quite understand.
Not a night elf; she was a high elf. So okay. Night elves.
Okay.
Were like the people from the tree place, and they were like druids and one of nature, right? The high elves were more like arcane, magical, and Sylvanas was a ranger or whatever for the high elves. And so her tragic story is that when Arthas came to the capital city, Silvermoon City, and he like decimated it with when he was the Lich King, not as a human. She gets turned into what's called a banshee, and they kind of expand upon this later. But yeah, she's actually a tragic story, and she was actually a pretty well-written character until like, you know, some freaking dyke or whatever got a hold of her. But she was actually a really well-written character. Now in Classic WoW, she's a faction leader for what's called the Forsaken, which are like the undead that join the Horde. They're not part of the Scourge, which is like the main undead. They kind of have this free will, except for they don't. I guess we can this is another thing that Blizzard really, they're kind of jumping around over the place, but I think this is really interesting, is that the undead, the Forsaken, were led by Sylvanas Windrunner, right? When she was undead. And it's, you know, they're getting risen by her. So when you start off like as an undead character, you actually started off in this crypt, and Sylvanas is like sort of necromancer revives you, and you're probably once a citizen of Lordaeron or someplace, right? You're kind of brought back against your will in order to serve her. And she is evil, and she's not ran by the Lich King or whatever, but in the original World of Warcraft, the Forsaken, the Horde actually, so the Tauren, which are the Minotaur race, the Orcs, the Trolls, they don't want to let the Forsaken in, but they kind of have to because they're outnumbered by the Alliance. And they want to let her in because they know she's just evil. And she's like, oh, yeah, I'll play ball, guys. But she's like, I want to kill everyone in the world because I'm such a miserable person. Everyone's got to be miserable with me. Like, misery loves company. So she hates all living people. This is very much in the lore. If you ever do get a quest from her in Undercity, which is the capital of the undead, or the race in World of Warcraft, is the Undercity, which is under the ruins of Lordaeron, which holds a very special lore place in the Warcraft universe, because if you play Warcraft 3, Lordaeron's this cool human kingdom. Stormwind is kind of like this afterthought, and Lordaeron is like the main. And you actually, in order to get to the Undercity, which is in the sewers, which is gross and it's stupid looking, but of the sewers of Lordaeron, you have to go into the throne room where Arthas killed his father. So that's another thing about World of Warcraft that like we kind of glossed over was, You played all these zones in Warcraft 3, met all these characters and these great lore moments, and in World of Warcraft, you can actually walk up and touch it. Like, actually go to the place where Arthas killed his father. And if you actually wait in the lore room for like 5 minutes, you'll hear the whispers of that interaction from Warcraft 3 where Arthas kills his father in the throne room. It's a really nice touch. But anyways, yes, but Sylvanas, who's a banshee now, she's evil. Now back to Burning Crusade with sort of the blood elves being this magic. She was once a high elf. Now the high elves, when Arthas destroyed what is called, I think it was like the magical well they got their powers from. they had to find something else to get their powers from. And so what they ended up doing is they ended up making the Sunwell, which Sunwell was, they captured this, what is basically, it used to be an angel in the Warcraft universe. I think they recently retconned it, but this creature called the Naru, and they basically torture it to death. They start torturing it. They give them magical powers, right? And they're like addicted to magic and mana. Like they have to have it or they die. They're crack addicts, but they're like a beautiful race. It's kind of funny. They're like a beautiful celebrity who's like addicted to heroin or some. It's really like kind of, again, Blizzard, like bravo. Like you made like a really kind of compelling racial sort of story there with the Blood Elves. Anyways, Burning Crusade. There's all this end game content to do, but I wouldn't say anything has to do with the end of the world either in the Burning Crusade. Cause like, and this has to go with, I don't think Blizzard really sold what the Burning Legion was, and the Burning Legion are kind of like the overarching bad guys. They're like a demon legion that wants to kill all life or subjugate all life. And they're kind of like chaos in 40K where they're like just pants on head retarded and don't get anything right. And are just kind of losers. Anyway, so Burning Crusade happens, and people like love it because new races, new questing zones, new end game content, and you know all that. But what really World of Warcraft's hype and story and everything was when Wrath of the Lich King was announced, which was the third expansion to World of Warcraft. And this is the expansion where you go back to Northrend and you have to defeat the Lich King and put the, you know, and put Arthas in his place and kill the Lich King. And this is like, you know, the reason why is because people got into World of Warcraft because of the Frozen Throne. Now, I was just a kid that saw an MMORPG. I was like, oh my God, this is beautiful. But Lich King was when these... sort of like everyone was like, and a lot of people who didn't play World of Warcraft or the Burning Crusade originally came into the game to play Wrath of the Lich King. You actually saw this in the subscriber numbers in World of Warcraft, where it's kind of hovered around 5 to 6 million and went up to 12 or 14 million during its height of Wrath of the Lich King because people wanted to finally finish the story of Arthas Menethil and sort of that tragedy. Anyways, yeah, sorry, I've got to take up all the mic time. If you want to, please interject whatever you want.
Lewis, you've been quiet for a while. Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I guess I don't know. So the lore of Warcraft stuff has always been like the least interesting part to me. Because I didn't play it. I was too young at the time, and I had like one friend who was into it. All my friends all played RuneScape, which is a whole different thing because it was free. And looking back, I think we might have been poor. I don't know. You know, it's hard to tell when you're a kid. But couldn't do the whatever nine like what is it, $20 up front and then $10 a month for the whole thing.
Yeah, 15 a month. Yeah, it's been like that for the past like I guess 20 years now. Jeez.
Yeah. So my big experience with Warcraft and all the and World of Warcraft and all that stuff is I only ever played Dota, so you know.
Oh yeah. I love Dota. Just for the audience, if you guys want to do racisms or like say that like, you know, nigger and stuff like that in games and not get in any trouble, go on Dota. Valve does not, side note, Valve does not police their chat whatsoever. It's great. Dota's a fun game still to this day. Dota 2. But
yeah.
Dota
also is like aggressively like super hard as well. Like you, it's like it's incomprehensibly. Yeah. I'm actually like, you know, I'm kind of anti lore dumps. And I kind of think that was my more about the World of Warcraft was that like what it did to Blizzard and like the entire industry, because World of Warcraft made more money than like any game before it. In it, like ever,
yeah,
because you had to buy it every month, you know, and
it was an initial cost for like I think it was like $40 or $50 for the initial like box, and then that subscription too, yeah. So you just had this, you know, the pay as you go model, and yeah, it was massive.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, also they eventually realize that the money is not in that initial cost. It's in the monthly cost of the games as a service kind of thing. And they made so much absolutely retarded
money. They were doing well after Warcraft. They were doing well after Warcraft 2. They were doing really well after Warcraft 3.
For a game studio, yeah.
After World of Warcraft, they became big enough to essentially, I believe they acquired Activision, not the other way around. I'd have to double check that, but
no, Activision acquired them. They actually recently split too.
Yeah, right. But the point is, like, I mean, essentially they're going toe to toe with EA at that point.
Yeah.
In the early 2000s.
Well, yeah, it's so, even now in World of Warcraft in its sad state, like I freaking hate the retail game, right? It is such a massive moneymaker. It is such like it still to this day is, and it's a shit game and people fucking hate playing it, but they hate playing it, right? So yeah, no, it's, and that's why Microsoft bought Blizzard recently. Microsoft bought Blizzard. So it's a big deal. Still, yeah, they still make money hand over fist.
But also, it changed the entire industry of making video games, because everyone started chasing the idea that you make money off both expansion packs, which became DLC. Like, DLC became a thing because of, I mean, there were like obviously instances of it in Infinity Checker for it, but DLC, every game had to have DLC after like 2008 when people realized how much money Blizzard had made. And also the idea of like games as a service, and Blizzard even changed their model to match it, where they make the first bit free, and then you start paying for like...
Yeah, the first 20 levels in WoW are free. So you can like make a WoW account and play the game. I highly don't recommend it. There's all this furry shit now in the game, and it's really not what it was.
The shit got so big, I think, towards the third... I don't know when... I guess it was in the middle or the... I guess it's the middle now, but it was like after the hype. I remember like watching fucking Monday Night Football, and they have a commercial for the World of Warcraft Panda fucking China expansion.
Yeah, Mr. Pandera.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, I'm never playing that game. I always thought in my back of my mind, oh, okay, maybe one day I'll get into WoW.
Right. Then, like, you share the sentiment with most of the people that saw that.
And I was like, it's like darker and grittier Kung Fu Panda shit. And like, who is this? Is this just for like literal Chinese people? Like,
I had the exact same reaction. I was like, it was always kind of in the back of my mind. It's like, yeah, maybe I'll try it out someday. I don't know. And I saw the panda thing, and I was like, are you, what?
Okay.
Like, so they were so proud of it. Monday Night Football had commercials. They were like, so like, oh, this is gonna be the coolest shit ever, guys. And I like,
you know what's really funny? This is a perfect segue in what we really wanted to get to, DK, which was. And I know you hate lore drums, Lewis, but this is kind of the thing, is Garrosh Hellscream. So you guys, this is why World of Warcraft sort of transcends its own story quite a bit. So everyone, plays classic, plays Burning Crusade. You have like Mr. T and like, I think Tom Cruise doing commercials for World of Warcraft. It's freaking you and the mini B guy, the midget who played in Austin Powers doing commercials for like, World of Warcraft play. I play World of Warcraft. Like, it's a cool thing, right? And you have these compelling stories and these cool zones. And then Cataclysm comes out, and Cataclysm is the fourth expansion. They introduce this character called Garrosh Hellscream. He becomes the leader of the Horde. Not really important where he comes from. His father was Grom Hellscream, and he's the guy, orc that initially drank demon blood in order to, like, become powerful, but he was dominated like Arthas in terms of their mind. But Garrosh Hellscream. Oh my, so he's pretty much just our guy, Hitler. And it's so freaking hilarious how Blizzard writes Garrosh Hellscream. So Garrosh Hellscream takes over the Horde, right? And he sees like the fighting has been going on for years between the Alliance and the Horde. And he's like, you know what? This is screw this. We're going to end this freaking war. We're going full, full send, full ham. We're no more, no quarter, none of these half. Because throughout the expansions, the Horde and the Alliance never like, they always have these times to finish each other off, and they just never do it because of honor and integrity. And Garrosh Hellscream was like, no, screw this. I'm in charge now of the, of the Horde and of the orcs. We're gonna freaking screw them. We're gonna go full send. We're gonna kill everyone. So in Cataclysm, what they did was they took the old world and they revamped it, they remodeled it, and it was really controversial at the time and still is today. But what's really funny is that there's a thing what Grosh does is called the bombing of Theramore. And this is where World of Warcraft gets silly and they have like guns and tanks and stuff, but like it's a fantasy universe. It's just so dumb and silly. But they basically create a nuclear weapon called a mana bomb, and they bomb Theramore, which is like Jaina Proudmoore's.
Wait. A nuclear mana bomb?
Yes, a nuclear mana ice, dude. It's what they do. They make a nuclear mana bomb. And so it's played off when he nukes Theramore, which is like Jaina's like, you know, sort of fortress, that the other leaders in the Horde are like, how could you do an Hiroshima or like a, how could you do that? And Grosh is like, literally, like, it was literally a military target. These are the Alliance, you know, fags. Like, fuck this. Bombing of Theramore, best day of my life. And this is where you see a split in the player base, too. So, like, if you go to the old WoW forums to this day, they still have posts. You can go on YouTube. Grosh did nothing wrong. And this is a bunch of different things, right? So all the other leaders of the Horde start conspiring because conservative faggots. Ineffective conservative faggotry happens, right? And they're like, oh, man, bombing people's bad. And then Grosh is like, well, you ain't seen nothing yet. And this starts, like, slaughtering, like, this going full ham on the Alliance. And the Alliance was like, whoa, I thought we had, like, this, you know, this idea that, you know, we do this ineffective battling for years and, you know, all the normies die, but us leaders get to live the entire time. And Grosh is, like, leading his armies, like, from the front, like, no, we're finally going to finish this. He's like, you know, he's like sort of like this, you know, Adolf Hitler character. He's like, no, I've been through enough of these goddamn wars. We're going to finish it. So, and in fact, but he's also still got moral values, too, because Sylvanas, and this is the fourth expansion of World of Warcraft, right? So there's a lot of things that happen. Now she's like sort of like a main character. You redo her model and, you know. So he goes and visits Sylvanas in Tristfall Glades. And she's our Silver Pine Forest, rather. And the other thing, she's like, okay, Sylvanas, what are you doing? I'm the Horde, you know, I'm the warlord of the Horde now, the war chief. What are you doing? And Sylvanas is like, oh, I'm using these Valkyr, which she got from Northrend, which are like these, what were the Norse Valkyries? Valkyries, yeah, Valkyr Valkyries. And I'm killing a bunch of people with the plague. Well, by the way, Sylvanas actually gasses people, go figure, like using literal chemical warfare and gasses people and raises them from the dead. And Grosh Hellscream's like, this is disgusting war crime shit. Like, no, like Sylvanas, like you're wrong in gassing people and raising them as the dead. This is a disgusting practice. Quit doing it. And Sylvanas is like, so again, and you'll see a bunch of shit on the forums. And this is why I know, Lewis, I'm bored you floor dumps here, but this was a huge controversial thing in World of Warcraft because all the liberals on the forums were like, well, Sylvanas gassing people is actually completely okay because she's like this strong female character that no one understands me. And Grosh is like, you know, so this male Chad character goes like, you can't just gas people like that. That's like I listen. And she's like, well, you just bombed Theramore. And he's like, yeah, that was a military target. You're killing civilians. And you'll see these liberals on the WoW forums literally defend Sylvanas' actions. And this goes on for years, by the way, because Sylvanas is still like a main character. But and then, anyways, Garrosh is doing more and more of these things during the Cataclysm. But it's kind of like a backdrop to like what Thrall, and there's a dragon, and they shoot dragons of lasers, yada, yada, save the world. Okay, cool. Now we go with the Mists of Pandaria, which is what we were just talking about. So, like you, most of the WoW player base saw Mists of Pandaria and like, screw this, I'm out. Like, Kung Fu Panda, we're not doing this thing. But I will argue that Mists of Pandaria is the most cool, like, expansion ever. Because it, like, they really, the writers in Blizzard really wanted to make Grosh Hellscream the bad guy. In fact, he's the final boss of Mists of Pandaria. It's called the Siege of Orgrimmar. You defeat him in a raid. And he is just the most effective leader. Like, he's doing everything right. He's like, all these other Horde leaders that are like conspiring against him. He's like, screw this. I have a secret police force now. Excuse me, my freaking alarm's going off. He's actually doing all this based stuff. And he's like, you know what? all these other races, they're either like, you know, these disgusting undead or war criminals, these peace-loving dumb Tauren who like don't know, like they don't want to fight and actually defeat their enemies, are these you know, marijuana smoking trolls. Like, screw that, orcs are the real race. So he goes full racial supremacy in like Mists of Pandaria, and he's just doing the most effective shit. He's like, okay, how do I defeat the Alliance? Okay, I have to go to Pandaria, this new continent with a rape bit of resources to fund the war effort. And you know, like, you know what, screw, we're gonna, you know, screw the pandas. But he's like totally anti-panda. He's like, screw the pandas. You know, they're like, if they, some of them want to fight for us, cool, but they have to be like sort of like mercenary slaves in a way, and like this underclass. Because you can play as a panda now and pick what faction, whatever. But during the entire expansion, he's just doing the most based stuff. And everyone who's like on the floor, dude, Garrosh Hellscream's the good guy. Garrosh Hellscream knows how to win a war, right? And so at the end, the Alliance sort of like, it's like World War II, where like a lot of these Wehrmacht generals were like, these conservative guys were betraying Hitler at the end. You know, and switching sides and so on, or surrendering or whatever. The Alliance reaches out to the Horde leaders that are kind of sort of disenfranchised with the Horde and Garrosh, and they're like, let's all overthrow Garrosh. Garrosh gets wind of this and goes like, screw you guys, I'm the war chief. You guys don't want to, you guys are conspiring with your lifelong enemies. You're literally conspiring to the people that have killed your women and children for years. Like, Garrosh goes like, they have killed your, like, your sons and your fathers and your grandfathers, and you want an ally with them? Like, why do you want to ally with the people that have killed you for centuries? Like, for decades. Like, screw you. So anyway, you eventually fight Garrosh. You put him in chains, and the pandas, because he like basically does a WMD in Panda Land 2 as well, and like kind of corrupts the entire place. And Garrosh, and they kind of bring him to the trial, right? They bring him to this trial, and during the trial, and so instead of this killing him, right, when they capture him, they're like, no, we're conservatives, we have to have a Nuremberg trial. So they literally have a Nuremberg trial where they're trying him. And during the trial, like at nighttime, there's these different characters that talk to him and like, hey, Garrosh, like, you know, like, just, you know, just admit to your crimes, man. Like, it'll be cool. It will throw you in prison. You know, it'll be fine. And Garrosh goes like, okay, yeah, maybe I'll do that thing. And Garrosh actually starts like sort of like mind fucking with them a little bit. So the day comes where Garrosh is going to put like his verdict in. And everyone in the entire crowd, and the pandas and, you know, the Horde and the Alliance characters that are there, they go like, they're like, okay, Garrosh is going to admit to his crimes. We're going to put this to bed. We can have a conservative law and order, whatever. And Garrosh Hellscream goes like, I'm sorry for absolutely fucking nothing. I'll do it all fucking over again. Gas the Alliance, gas the Horde, race war now, orc supremacy. And he gets magicked away. This is another stupid thing they do. He gets magicked away by like a dragon to Draenor in the past. And there's like, there's a meme where like they get in the Garrosh Hellscream, gets in the DeLorean and goes back in time. But he like literally goes like, hey, are you guilty of these war crimes? And he's like, yeah, I'm guilty. And I'd fucking do it again. It's just the most beautiful thing in World of Warcraft. Because when that happened, it was like a beautiful thing. It was just like, people were freaking out. People were like, oh my gosh, Blizzard, why can't we just kill, you know, Garrosh Hellscream? And other people are like, no, Garrosh is the true leader. And a lot of people switched from like Alliance to Horde because of Garrosh. You know, before, the Horde was seen as like the mud people, right? And the Alliance was seen as like the white people race with like culture and architecture. But it was like, he made the Horde cool. And people wanted to play the Horde because of at least for lore reasons. So the next, go ahead.
This does get into one thing I want to talk about that's like kind of, I guess, lore related, but like more, I guess, just narrative and how narratives work. And, you know, post 1945 is that fantasy and Warcraft in particular, it's like, it's based around, you know, different races and like racial conflict. But because of like, I don't know, certain priors and, you know, Maholocaust or whatever, they don't like, people actually don't care about like other races, civilians. Because like, yeah, like it's basically like the idea that you could have a racial holy war between like this alliances of races that are like both genocidal and then have like also like Napoleonic tier rules about like not shooting officers and things, or like, you know, don't kill enemy leaders and stuff, is extremely, extremely stupid and doesn't make any sense. Like, it's either a war for your race to survive, or it's like a fantasy, you know, we're fucking around doing nothing bit, but it really can't be both.
Yeah, like exactly. And Blizzard in this tries to have its cake and eat it too, where it's like, I guess that's a wrong term. It like says like, Grosh is this evil war criminal, but like everything he does is like relatable, and he does it with like good intentions. Like, listen, I don't want to bomb Theramore with this nuclear weapon we have, but we have to do it. This has been a thorn in our side. It's a base of alliance operations. We've got to destroy it, right? And then, like, they try to play it off like, no effective measures are acceptable because it's horrifying. Like, it's like, Blizzard, what are you saying? Like, what are you trying to say? Are you trolling us? Like, how is this good? Like, how?
It also speaks, I think, to a related phenomenon, which the tedious guys often talk about in a science fiction context, particularly with, and we mentioned before too, but in Star Trek, where there's a conceit that different races are kind of like the different, because like humanity is one race, right? And for the purposes of fantasy,
yes.
But because all of this kind of high fantasy stuff and its derivative, you know, like obviously Tolkien, but also its derivative products like Warhammer and Warcraft and so on and so on and so on, are like, that's all written by white people. It all plays to, is based upon white cultural norms and expectations. Yeah. The like, whether, you know, there's, you know, you may have had, there's obviously nowadays we got like, you know, Lord Dem Rangs and black elves and shit like that, which is ridiculous in an even more absurd way. But even prior to that, even though you might have a token kind of, you know, black character or whatever, a black human character, or, you know, Geordi LaForge on The Next Generation, they were all white. They were all like, you know, the humanity is white. And when people talk about like, and this is where you get phenomena, I don't think we sort of mentioned it offhand, but we were talking about more before the show, one of the characters in Warcraft 3 is like a quote unquote human supremacist, right? And he's kind of played within the game context, the writers are trying to present his, you know, kind of like, he actually has, if you know, this Warcraft introduced this thing where if you click a bunch on units, they'll say funny shit. One of the things that he says if you click on it a bunch is the only good non-human is a dead non-human. Which is grammatically kind of a weird thing to say. Like, you would think that in this world they'd have a word for a non-human that was like a, you know, but frankly, it would be a racial epithet insult. But in any case, it's extremely base thing to say, but it goes to show you the extent to which, like, you see this especially also in Star Wars, even more so in the kind of expanded universe lore, but to some extent, just in the original movies, like the moral problem with the Empire is framed in terms of the Empire is a human supremacist organization, quote unquote human supremacist, right? And so like it's kind of it's interesting, right, to observe how in the minds of the writers who themselves are libtards, they themselves are betraying their kind of internal implicit sense that actually only white people are human, right? Like to be a human supremacist is to be a white supremacist, because it's like to be a human in the context of this lore is to behave like a white person, to have civilization like a white person, like white people, to have cities like the cities that white people, like Europeans, have built, maybe Asia, you know, obviously, you know, but you get what I'm saying. Lewis, it sounded like you had some input.
Yeah, well, this trope goes back all the way to, like, I think the first example of it actually is, like, Asimov and Heinlein writing their books, and they'll make their character, like, in Starship Troopers, like, it's, like, kind of offhand, but, like, he's Filipino. Like, the main character's Filipino. He's from Manila, at least, but everybody's just white, you know? Or, like, you know, I'm from Buenos Aires, has to kill them all. But like, they're all white people. Like, everyone's white because it's, and Asimov did the same bit where like they'll have like Chinese scientists come over to America or whatever. Or, like, you know,
but they all just act like white.
Like, to be a character is to be white, even if you like code that character as black with this black sprites, you know.
And the reason why, and my theory for this is the reason why is because like no other race. Well, actually, Asians probably have a lot of this, especially the Japanese sort of tales. But like Europeans are the ones who have all like the ideas that have all these sort of like, you know, story structure in their folklore is like the idea of good and evil and the, you know, of consequences and morality and living with those consequences. These are all like sort of things that have been discussed in European folklore. So like when you have to talk about like when it's inherently white because that's what storytelling is. Like other unless you're talking about like Chinese and Japanese like folklore or like you're when you're writing this sort of story, like what do other races kind of have? They don't have like an interesting thing, whereas white people have discovered this through like, you know, Siegfried and you know, Icarus and all these other sort of stories. That's my just my take on it.
Frankly, it's as with the genetic divide between human, like the big divide in humanity in genetic terms is between Africans and non-Africans. And you see the same thing in civilization. Like India has classical civilization, China has classical civilization, even like, you know, Mesoamerica, South America had, you know, the Mayans, the Aztecs, it was brutal and bloodthirsty. And, you know, we're very, you know, Hernan Cortez did nothing wrong. But they had, you know, monumental stone architecture, you know, logistically complicated civilization. The place where this is missing is Africa, right? So like, it just becomes a, like, it's just like the issue here is blacks.
Ah, yeah, I can definitely agree with that. Yeah, Lewis, you have anything else?
Yeah, because I think the, I'm trying to think how to explain it. I also want to talk about like how technologically wise there is some interesting stuff going on with like, you know, World of Warcraft as an MMO, because it's like the whole bit is what, like there's thousands of players in one world, but there's actually not, like they're cheating to achieve it.
Yeah.
Like the system of it, well, it's innovative, but like the instance system in itself as a like piece of technology, I think is really interesting, where basically you are, there's like a fake overworld that's full of people doing very little undemanding things. But as soon as you got to get a bunch of players into a fight, it basically loads all the players into a lobby. And then you're basically playing like, you know, relatively not, I don't say unimpressive, because like what, 40 characters was a lot for the time, but it wasn't unheard of, you know?
Well, actually, you kind of have a few things wrong here. So in the original classic WoW, when it first launched, there was there was dungeons and like raids, which were instanced, but that was mainly because like if you had, so each server when World of Warcraft started capped at 2,000 characters, right? So the overworld, you're doing questing. You can, the original player versus player mechanic was you went into overworld and you found an orc and you killed him because he had green skin. Right, like, or you found a gnome and you ate them or something, right? Like that's like what you did to like get these honor points in order to like, you know, get gear and stuff. It wasn't till very recently in World of Warcraft where they did that sort of, you know, a smoke and mirrors thing with what's called a layering, where because it used to be an ecosystem where everyone's kind of playing in this thing, right? But now everything's kind of, you get put on a layer. And they kind of like separate you in these different sort of instance environments. And maybe you'll have like 40 people near you, but you're kind of away from everyone else. Back in that was one of the big selling points of World of Warcraft, because it was at very little loading times. You could go to the entire continents without seeing a loading screen. Maybe you move into an instance, it would be. Now, with the invention of battlegrounds, to do like those PvP battles, and you'll have people like me saying battlegrounds ruined the game, because what do you want of a world like an MMO? You want to live in the world, breathe in the world, and when you take the player out of the world, the game becomes less special. The world doesn't matter as much, right? And so what World of Warcraft ended up being, especially nowadays in retail WoW, is that it is that lobby. The world is just kind of a lobby, and you queue up for dungeons, you get teleported to the dungeon, you queue up for battlegrounds, get teleported to the battleground. And actually the player interaction is completely gone. So when Blizzard, this has been a while for, that's why they've been losing sub numbers, because that sort of like the MMO aspect has been lost. And when Blizzard announced classic servers after, and that's a whole episode in itself, I imagine, is like the Astralis and how classic WoW came to be, because that was a huge drama thing. But I digress on that. The thing about like classic WoW is that all these players came back. They crashed Blizzard servers because they were, you know, that you could finally play with your friends again, and the world mattered. And that was really special. So like as the game went on, it kind of became more of this like, maybe you play with one or two people, but classic WoW comes back. Now all of a sudden you're playing with 40 people again. There's all this drama because you have to create all this gear, and it relies on an ecosystem of like an economy and material gathering and sort of so on. Yeah.
Yeah, that is something we'll probably do at some point, like the classic MMORPG resurgence, which might have actually just been like, it's kind of not linked to it, but a lot of it was like, I don't know, you want to call it just like, it got huge, at least for me. I never played it actually, but like a lot of my friends talk about going to classic RuneScape during like the pandemic and stuff.
Yeah.
But
our,
like
the, our what's the other one? Not RuneScape, but EverQuest. Yeah.
I had friends who were getting into like playing like Magic. What is it? Magic 101 or like the kiddie one? They have one of the, because the one was the one they played as kids.
Yeah.
Like all those like WoW imitators, even like they got like big resurgences kind of somewhat recently, but people don't want to play like the remaster. They just want to play like, I want old thing because old thing good, which is true probably in these cases.
And the gameplay is janky. Like classic WoW, the gameplay is janky. The classics don't play as right, but it's something that's just transcends that. It's the community that you play in, right? Like back in the day, I used to be part of this guild, and we used to like kill each other in like Dalaran, which is a base capital city. We used to kill each other in forms of swastikas, and we used to like, there used to be a ability when you're a human called human supremacy, and we used to spam that in trade chat, right? Like, and you would piss everyone off, and you could only be a human in our guild. Like, there, like people like remember that sort of stuff. And now in World of Warcraft, you don't kind of have that anymore. Our class, or in MMOs in general, like there's no sense of community. But back in the day, you could be the bad guy on your server, the good guy, or you could be like, you know, the guy you depend on to be the main tank in the raid, or this is the best warrior PvPer on the server. Like, this is the guy you talk to about being a warrior. Like, you don't have that anymore. It's just kind of just a lobby. This is what it is.
Yeah, I'd be curious to look back, because like now all the a lot of games are using like, even like obviously chat filters, voice filter, like you can get banned for saying certain words and phrases, and that does kind of degrade like what an MMORPG is, because also like the idea of reports, like reporting somebody, you know, like, oh well, he killed me in the PvP zone, I'm gonna like snitch on him, like that's a, you know, a RuneScape thing, like, oh, this person tricked me into giving me all their shit, therefore, you know, oh, it was like tough shit back then, but now it's, you can like report fag and stuff, and that stuff kind of is cancer. Also, it makes these games not profitable, because you do this, report fagging is expensive. You need this expensive infrastructure to like snitch and report fag and review claims and counterclaims, and you need like basically not lawyers, but like they actually act as like arbitrators, all these people who need to regulate banned.
Well, they automate it now, so you can do well, like, they,
you, yeah. The thing is, you can, but you even when you do that, you create, because you have to have an ability to appeal, right? So like, even just deal with appeals. You get this very expensive thing, moderation or like on that level is difficult and expensive, and it probably puts a big soak into their income. I mean, isn't that like one of Elon's pitches to like the ADL was that like, well, I'll have the guys, my guys can, it's probably bullshit, but like my programmers can handle automating, like, you know, automating morality. if you just let us, you know, buy this thing. You know, but you can't. It's always when you're always have to have like real people at the end of the day, because like, you know, why can't, if I, because I will always, if I get banned on your platform for saying the N-word, I will appeal and tell you I'm black, you know, for my account. And, you know, I need someone somewhere to be there proving that, you know, because at the end of the day, you can't, like, or you get this funny thing with moderation, because like the people that talk about like banned topics the most are like those groups. Like, you remember the story a long time ago, Facebook banned like explicit sexual talk. Like, they filtered like certain really gross, you know, sex words. And like gay, like Facebook groups had, there was a massive outcry because they were all getting banned and shut down because that's all they talk about.
Yeah.
And Twitter had a, yeah, it's just like, oh yeah, well, I can't have a fisting anymore. What is the, where's my community? You know, there's no fist without fisting. There is no gay community, I guess. And the same thing happened on Twitter early with, it's like one of the lessons you can take from, you know, that they probably teach, like, you know, young aspiring automated Janny builders now, is that like they did a blanket ban or a nearly blanket ban on the N-word. And Twitter has always been like the most black of all the, like, black in the user base of all the social medias.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah. And it like obviously show what, like, you, they basically banned like all the black people for, like, oh fuck, we just gentrified Twitter, you know, we just fixed the platform, but they had, like, you know, obviously they had to undo it. And that's a big problem, because humans are just really bad at, or automated tools are just really bad at fixing. And also, people don't understand how racism works, and like political racism, where you can't, I can be racist anywhere. You can't put a word filter on me that will stop me from, like, you know, making increasingly like plain language claims, you know, Once you ban the phrase black and people, I'm good, you know?
Though, here's the thing, though. Like, it's funny you bring that up, and I'll tie this back to World of Warcraft, because a lot of, like, culture in World of Warcraft was derived from sort of online racism. So, especially back in like, in a couple expansions ago, what was really funny was replacing black people and, like, black crime statistics with orc crime statistics, and saying, you know, especially in Classic WoW now, you'll see on trade chat, like, you know, orcs are 13% of the player base, but commit over 55% of all violent crime in Azeroth. Like, like, how do you ban that? Like, how do you, like, you ban, like, the world orc? You ban 55%? Like, how do you go about, like, stopping that? Are the that's weird that gnomes have all the money and they're less than, like, 1% of the population. Like, it's just all these things. Like, yeah, it's funny you bring that up. DK, do you have anything?
I was actually going to ask if you had. I think that's probably a fairly good place to wrap up. Unless you had other thoughts.
No, I'm a Spurg, and I'll keep on going. Stop, cut me off now.
I think people, I mean, you know, it's there's always there's certainly more to discuss, but we can. I definitely envision returning to this well. At a later point. Yeah, I think definitely we I think people got a sense of, like, especially, you know, people like me who don't have much exposure, like the lore in this setting is endless and really kind of metastasized in mostly unfortunate ways. And that there's been this, like, yeah, this movement from kind of big broad strokes that have actually some real dramatic impact to just kind of endless irrelevant details for people to get wrapped up in, that nevertheless, I guess, you know, occasionally you have moments where you know, one particular writer or team of writers who are doing a good job, doing good work, can really impact the you know, make something that's, you know, unintentionally based in ways that are funny to observe. And yeah, cut against the kind of liberal priors of the team and of the perhaps even of the work as a whole, or maybe the liberal priors. Or again, I'm always sort of like stepping back. As I was saying earlier, I think that anytime you have a game or any work of fiction or anything like that, that any kind of cultural product that involves this kind of that involves real world life and death stakes and real world sense of scarcity of resources, that it's going to have to end up being quote unquote red pilled to that extent. There's no more based poem than the Iliad, right? Okay, Lewis, did you have any concluding thoughts, or did you want to add to that thought at all? Or
No, I just want to say every time you bring up the Iliad, I have to say two things. One is that the Iliad is actually a historical work. Everything in it happened as it said. If you're not a Wahhabist Iliadist, you're not you're not welcome in my movement. And that's it. Yeah. So.
Cool, man. All right. Well, thanks, Ty Guy, for coming on. It was a blast having you on. I'm sure you'll be back. I think we got to discuss Syrian warfare at some point. And till next time, take care, everybody. I'm an